Yeah. When that guy, he kind of combats with Imam Ali, and he falls, and Imam Ali was about to strike him, he spits on the face of Ali. He didn't take it personally. He walks around a bit, makes sure the anger is cooled down. That's when he strikes afterwards, just to make sure that he doesn't take things personally.
We
That's
see
maturity.
This in the Sirah of the Ahlul Bayt as well. When Imam Baqir alayhi salam, he's out there and he's plowing the field, he's working really hard, and this guy comes over and he wants to mock him, and he says, "Hey, Baqir," and which means cow. What is his reply? This reply is brilliant. He goes, "My name is Baqir, not Baqir." The hadith goes on, but I want to leave it just there, right?
That's maturity.
That's maturity. You can just give somebody such an intellectual and straightforward response that they don't know what to say after that.
At the same time, you'd find these people playing with kids as if they were kids.
Alhamdulillah.
That's still maturity. Not because you're playing with kids doesn't mean that you're immature. You playing with kids mean that you're properly mature, because you know who is your audience and how to deal with them. All right, that's it for now. That's the time we have. Me and Brother Muzaffar here for the Youth Station, RRB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome back to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. The favourite to become the next leader of Scotland, the Scottish Health Secretary, Hamza Yousaf, has caused a huge debate in the Muslim community by saying he believes that same-gender marriage is equal to heterosexual marriage, a position which Islam does not condone. So on today's show, we're going to discuss to what extent Muslim politicians should represent their faith in public life. Here's more context on the story.
A new issue has risen for Muslims living in the West. Politicians from a Muslim background compromising on Islam in order to further their political careers. The most recent example was seen in Scotland, with Scottish Nationalist Party leadership candidate Hamza Yousaf taking the un-Islamic position of supporting same-sex relationships when questioned by journalists about his religious stance.
Just to be crystal clear on this, do you think that gay sex is sin?
Oh, look, I've answered this question time and time and time and time again. No matter how many times, Sophie, you ask the question, I believe in equal marriage. I believe that people's marriage, if they are gay and they are married, that their marriage is no less, is no more inferior or less, is worth less than my marriage as a heterosexual.
Other prominent examples of Muslim politicians abandoning Islamic norms include American Senator Ilhan Omar and British London Mayor Sadiq Khan, both of whom have been condemned by traditionalist Muslims for their pro-LGBT stances, among other controversial positions, including support for Israel and the Western war machine.
My name is Sadiq Khan. And now more so than ever before, I say it's with great pride, I am the Mayor of London!
Some argue that compromising is a necessary evil in order to gain Muslims political representation. However, Muslims in high office rarely ever champion issues of concern to the community, particularly Islamic positions, which are considered controversial according to Western worldviews. The issue can be so divisive between Muslims that some scholars now condone the opinion that Muslims should not engage in the democratic process of disbelieving nations. But the debate rages on.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Muslims in public life, we have Lubaba Khalid, who is currently a Young Labour BME officer and previously was the Vice President of Welfare at the University of Westminster Student Union. Her work has centred on the attainment gap, decolonialisation of the university and anti-racism work. Lubaba, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Now, just tell me, what do you make of this story coming out of Scotland? It's obviously a difficult situation that Hamza Yusuf has been put in. It seems as if he's being focused on specifically because of his Muslim background.
Yeah, that's the reality because, you know, he's running against another candidate who is a very strong Christian. I've now forgotten her name. What's her name?
Forbes,
yeah. You know, and she's a strong Christian and she was asked the same questions around, you know, gay sex and things like that. And she didn't get the same backlash as Hamza Yusuf. So one can only think that, can only come to the conclusion that the backlash that he's getting and the question that he's come is inherently from an Islamophobic position than it being about the politics that he's running on and the policies that he would like to see if elected.
It seems as if Muslims are in this rock and a hard place. They're kind of stuck where if they choose to stand by traditionalist Islamic interpretations, the kind of thing they would have been brought up to believe, then, of course, they'll become potentially persecuted. They won't be able to pursue mainstream careers, for example, like Hamza Yusuf. If he took a different position on this subject, I doubt he would have been treated so well. Mm-hmm. Even though he took a pro-Western viewpoint on this issue, he's still being grilled by the media. But I think with Forbes, the Christian alternative, she has taken some controversial positions as well from a mainstream position, but because, you know, she's white British, she's perhaps given the freedom to be controversial without this kind of like, well, her career's going to be completely destroyed as a result of that. Just tell me, as someone, as a Muslim yourself in this country who's, you know, getting involved in politics now, what's the atmosphere like for Muslims in the political sphere right now?
It's very hostile. It's hostile. It is a struggle to find the balance where we're not compromising our morals and our religion, but also wanting to create that change in society and things like that. So it is really tough. A lot of Muslim politicians that may have started off with the right politics and the right reasons and the right morals and things like that for now have been forced to accept these ideas that do contradict our religion. And we shouldn't be somewhat scared to say that. It is written in our scriptures. It is written. These things are not acceptable in Islam. But we're now in a situation where we're being forced to. But then the reality is this is not accepted in the three Abrahamic faiths as well. And I think people do forget that as well. So
it seems like, because this is obviously a secular country by and large, I think, you know, to describe as a Christian country right now is quite rich.
Yeah.
It's hard to find someone who identifies as a Christian these days.
Yeah.
So it seems as if there might be some kind of attack on religion. You mentioned quite rightly that this is a view that all the Abrahamic religions adhere to. It's not just Islam, but it seems as if anyone who is religious and pursues a public career, they can be demonized just for having those opinions, just for believing in their religion. And standing by those principles, they can be demonized. Do you think that that's the case?
I feel like there is a more acceptance to attack Muslims than it would be for, let's say, Catholics or Jewish people.
Really?
I feel like there is a more acceptance that society has created with, you know, with 9/11 and the narrative around terrorism and things like that, that it's become a lot more acceptable to frame Muslims as extreme, as their religion being extreme, than it is for other religions. I think currently that's where we are right now in terms of, yes, it might be something that's within all three religions, but I feel like it's accepted now within society that you can be Islamophobic and you won't be challenged on it. So.
Well, for more on this subject, we've also been able to speak to the veteran journalist Yvonne Ridley, who is currently a national executive member of the ALBA Party, which is a Scottish nationalist and pro-independence party.
Hamza Yusuf has boxed himself into a corner at the moment on mixed marriage, and you have to wonder, well, he's sounding more like a career politician than a conviction politician, whereas one of his rivals for the First Minister leadership is Kate Forbes, who is a committed Christian, but she's obviously, looking at her background, more of a conviction politician. She has come out, drawn her red lines. I will do this, I believe in this, but I will not agree to certain issues. At the end of the day, all of these politicians, regardless of whatever faith they hold, they are representing a mixed community, people of faith and people of no faith. And so in order to represent them fairly, they can't afford to have too many red lines that are going to upset certain religious or even non-religious sensibilities. Some people might think that Muslims are on a hiding to nothing because if they embrace the fortitude of Kate Forbes, who was quite adamant about her religious position on legislation, their critics would say, oh, this is Islamism coming into it. This politician is a fundamentalist, he's an extremist, he's dangerous. And, of course, we all know in Britain that Islamophobia really is a very long word for racism. And, unfortunately, we know that Britain, especially in the establishment, is institutionally racist. It's just there. So politicians from the Islamic faith, especially olive-skinned politicians, wouldn't be given the same latitude that Kate Forbes has been given. In fact, her rather obstinate position, non-negotiable position on same-sex marriages, has earned her a lot of respect because she has stood by her guns. So it may be that her position to refuse to compromise anything that would affect her faith may actually serve her well in the end, because people do like politicians who are decisive. The danger is that Muslims will not engage, will withdraw into an Islamic bubble and not get involved in politics. And that is the last thing that we want to see. I have lived in Scotland now for more than 10 years and can see the difference between the Scottish communities and the English communities, Muslim communities. And the Scottish Muslims are very happy to wave the Scottish saltire, the blue and white flag, and celebrate the famous poet Robbie Burns, and celebrate St. Andrew's Day, which is the patron saint of Scotland. And they seem quite relaxed and able to do that. And, you know, Humza Yousaf, when he took his parliamentary oath, he swore on the Holy Quran while other ministers swore on the Bible. He swore on the Holy Quran. He was wearing a kilt in Islamic tartan. We have our own tartan in Scotland. And that message is so powerful. And what the message is saying is anyone, regardless of faith or skin colour, can take part in government. And this trickles down to kids who are looking up at these politicians and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Not just Muslims, Jews as well. Yeah. More than 40 Jewish Labour members have been, they've said, persecuted and hounded out of the party. Because since Keir Starmer arrived, we've now learned that there are two sets of Jews. There are good Jews who support Israel and are Zionists and are proud to say that they're Zionists. And then there are bad Jews who don't believe in Israel, are very hostile to human rights, abuses in Israel. And, of course, they're perceived to be bad Jews and have been thrown out of the party. With the exception, I think, of one who's decided to take legal action, and the Labour Party has apologised.
Well, before we continue the studio discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this. We spoke to two Muslims to give their issues on this particular subject.
Politicians like Sadiq Khan, who were elected on a basis that we're Muslim, should not go and compromise on their religion. I feel like if you're being elected on the basis of being a Muslim and you're representing a certain group of society, you shouldn't go against what they elected you on. And as a person who studies politics, it comes with democracy and representation as well. You're voted on a basis that people believe you're the person to put their ideas across, and once you start going against them, you shouldn't be in power.
Hi, everyone. My name is Itisham Salamikum. I'm a councillor for this area, so I'm at Wembley Hill. In the 5 years that I have been elected, I haven't actually been put into a position where I've had to compromise my principles. But not because of anything else other than we are believers in justice and equality, freedom and principles of empathy and compassion. The issue that's going on there, and I have differences, let's say. I'm trying to be diplomatic with those who have a stance on particularly the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is not right, I'll be honest. Our religion tells us not to kind of judge other people, but obviously in particular instances where we can have disagreements with them and we can have conversations, and I think that should be where we are allowed to have kind of differences of opinion, but at least we should have that conversation. If we stifle debate, then that is the point where they've already lost. If they want to stifle debate on certain issues and they're not open to having those conversations, then it shows like a lack of moral strength or intellectual integrity.
What about Baroness Wazi? Someone like her, did she compromise on her Islamic principles to remain in politics?
Irrespective of whichever party you are from, you need to make sure you don't compromise on your principles. And I know that she has done a lot trying to highlight the levels of Islamophobia that are present, again, not just within the Conservative Party, but across this country. We are still a racist, sexist, misogynistic kind of country, an old imperial, colonial kind of country. We still have the remnants of that. So in terms of what she has doing, it's positive that she is highlighting it. But if she's the lone voice, and let's be honest, the Tory party are so right-wing now that they are painting Muslims as the enemy. If she is a lone voice in that battle, then she can only do so much. Again, I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I don't agree with a lot of what, again, she stands, she's a member of a party that I totally and vehemently disagree with. But in terms of her as a person, as an individual, if she is the only person that's doing it...
Well, there you have it. Plenty of views we've heard on this issue now. Now, obviously, the LGBT issue in Scotland is not the only example of where Muslims have entered into politics in the West, and it appears as if they've had to compromise in one degree or another. Other areas would be, say, on the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause. It seems like London Mayor Sadiq Khan has expressed a great interest in going to visit Israel, for example, and is very happy to do so in his view. Ilhan Omar in the US, a Muslim senator, has voted for resolutions which are branded as pro-Israel as well, and also support for Western wars, that type of thing. So just tell me where you stand on this, Lubaba, because obviously I think most Muslims, if not all, would say that these are red line issues. We shouldn't be compromising on Palestine and other issues.
So in context, my mother is Palestinian, so Palestine is something I will never compromise on. I can't, because that is my identity. One thing I will never understand is when someone compromises on seeing the oppressed, because we know in Islam it is our responsibility as an ummah, as a community, to stand on the side of the oppressed. And that should not be controversial. That shouldn't be something that is striving debate or... what did the guy say that the previous on the video where, you know, having to be diplomatic about it? Mm. Personally, I don't think we do, not on something like Palestine, especially in something like Palestine, something that's happening right now in China with the Uyghur Muslims. Syria is another example. These are issues that, no, we don't need to be diplomatic about. We should be very clear that we will stand on the side of the people that are constantly being murdered on a daily basis, that their land is being taken away from. And that's what Islam tells us to do as well. And so I get very agitated, I get frustrated, obviously as a Muslim, but I think it's mainly as a Palestinian, when I see that people get elected on the oppression of my people and then they get elected and they throw it all away. And to be fair, this is not something that I've just seen among Muslims. You see it among the white left as well, that will talk about Palestine, will be openly talk about it, but then as soon as they get into their positions, they forget about it all. And so, yeah.
Do you think then in that case that there is an issue here? Because as you said, when Muslims get into politics, not talking about yourself here, but other candidates, when they get high-ranking levels in politics, they are expected to compromise on this. To be pro-Palestine, as we saw with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, can get you in a lot of hot water. So they may opt to go for a more mainstream opinion on it, which is to be impartial, if not basically pro-Israel on the subject.
Then what's the point of being in... What's the point of going up in ranks? What is the point? Then that's the question we have to ask ourselves then. Should we be encouraging Muslim representation in politics, in positions, to get them in positions of power, like, for example, Sadiq Khan as the current mayor, if that will not benefit us in any way or form and it then leads to compromise, then genuinely, and it's a question that I feel like we do need to ask ourselves, that should we be asking for that representation? Because is it not worse then? Because then what happens is that you have Muslims who are in positions of these positions of power, you could say, who've compromised on their views, and then there's an expectation now for any Muslim who decides to go into those positions of power to also compromise. So then the question really is, what's the point?
It
sounds very harsh, but that's the question we have to ask ourselves. Then is there a point in encouraging Muslim representation in the current political sphere that we're in?
Do you think that we actually have Muslim representation at the moment?
No, I actually... And again, this is... I actually believe we have socialist representation who just happen to be Muslim, who just happen to be people of colour. But I think it's a very pick-and-choose for a lot of Muslims. Like, I understand me, and, you know, one thing we are taught in Islam is not to assume what a person's going through.
Yeah.
But I do recognise they are under a lot of pressure, an enormous amount of pressure. I do recognise that. But at the same time, it really depends on the individual. If they were elected on the basis that they were Muslim before their politics, then you have an expectation and you have a responsibility to represent being a Muslim in its whole, and you can't pick and choose when to give things up and when to, you know, do that. But if you were elected on socialist policies or Tory policies or whatever it is, but then you just happen to be Muslim, then that's a different ball game altogether in terms of that discussion. But when you, and I think that's where the conversation with Sadiq Khan comes into account, is that he did play on that Muslim card. He played on being a son of a bus driver to get votes, to then get elected and not actually do anything for that community he claimed to, that he was serving. That's where the problem comes.
For sure. I appreciate your time. Of course, this situation is ongoing, so we'll have to see how it develops. But we have reached the end of the show. But thank you very much, Lubaba, for appearing
for
with us.
Me.
And thank you to everyone at home. This is another edition of Eye on Islam that successfully come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of the show. But for now, salamu alaikum.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a report from a House committee, Democrats say Donald Trump's White House has failed to report more than 100 gifts from foreign nations. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. U.S. broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The White House under former President Donald Trump failed to report more than 100 gifts given to him and his family by foreign governments during his time in office, and some of those gifts remain missing, according to a report released on Friday, 17th of March, by Democratic staffers on the House Oversight Committee. The missing gifts include a larger-than-life-size painting gifted to Trump by the President of El Salvador, and golf clubs from the Prime Minister of Japan valued at more than $7,200, according to the 15-page report. A decorated box valued at $450 that was gifted to Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law and White House advisor, is also unaccounted for, according to the report. The missing items are among 117 foreign gifts to Donald Trump and his family, valued at $291,000, that the White House failed to report to the State Department as required by federal law, according to the report. The committee's staffers relied on White House and National Archive records to determine which gifts weren't reported to the U.S. State Department. The unreported items included gifts from Chinese President Xi Jinping, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, and India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and many others. The discovery of these unreported foreign gifts raises significant questions about why former President Donald Trump failed to disclose these gifts to the public as required by law, the report said. A spokesperson for Donald Trump did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Under the Foreign Gifts and Decorations Act, foreign gifts given to federal officials or their families become the property of the U.S. government if their worth exceeds a certain value. For most of Donald Trump's time in office, that value was $415. It's currently $480. The White House is responsible for reporting gifts given to the president, vice president, and their families to the State Department, which publishes a report about all gifts given to government employees every year. The law stipulates that recipients can keep the gifts if they purchase them from the General Services Administration, GSA, but they are still required to be disclosed to the U.S. State Department. The rules are meant to prevent foreign governments from influencing U.S. officials. Many of the foreign gifts given to Donald Trump or his family members are still in possession of the General Services Administration, the National Archives, and other federal agencies, according to the committee's report. Some were auctioned off to the public and others were subsequently purchased by members of the Trump family, including a $24,000 Saudi dagger and a $13,500 vase that Jared Kushner purchased. The unreported gifts detailed in the committee's findings include a $35,000 dagger with an ivory handle, a $12,400 ceramic bowl, and a $12,000 silk carpet, and a $12,000 saber. The dagger was transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The bowl, carpet, and saber are in possession of the National Archives, which received many of the gifts once Donald Trump left office. The White House reported some foreign gifts given to Donald Trump and Jared Kushner, First Lady Melania Trump and Trump's daughter and White House advisor Ivanka to the State Department from 2017 to 2019, but it did not report all of them, the report said. It disclosed only one gift to Jared Kushner in 2020 and none for the rest of the Trump family. Democrats on the committee are saying they would continue to investigate whether the gifts had any effect on U.S. foreign policy. ABC News has also covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump's White House has failed to report more than 100 gifts from foreign nations worth more than $250,000. The federal officials have been unable to find a life-size painting of Donald Trump given by the president of El Salvador, as well as golf clubs from the prime minister of Japan, according to a report on Friday, 17th of March, from House Democrats. Among the unreported items are 16 gifts from Saudi Arabia worth more than $45,000 in all, including a dagger valued at up to $24,000, and 17 presents from India that include expensive cufflinks, a vase, and a $4,600 model of the Taj Mahal, according to the report from Democrats on the House Oversight Committee. Gifts above several hundred dollars that foreign officials give to the president, vice president, and their family members are required under the Foreign Gifts and Decorations Act to be reported to the U.S. State Department. The report from the House Democrats citing State Department records says the number of gifts reported by Donald Trump and his family members are lower than the number disclosed by previous presidents. All told, the report says, though the White House did report some gifts to State Department between 2017 and 2019, it failed to report more than 100 foreign gifts, with a total value of over $250,000. The report says federal officials have not been able to locate a life-size painting of Donald Trump that, according to internal White House correspondence, was commissioned by the president of El Salvador and delivered to the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador as a gift to Donald Trump just before the 2020 presidential election. According to the report, the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador alerted U.S. officials to the gift and requested help in shipping it. The report says that there are no records of the painting's disposition by the National Archives and Records Administration or the General Services Administration, but that some records suggest it may have been moved to Florida in July of 2021 as property of Donald Trump. Also unaccounted for are thousands of dollars in golf clubs given to Donald Trump in 2017 and 2018 by Shinzo Abe, then the Prime Minister of Japan. The clubs, which the report says included a putter valued at $460 and a driver valued at $3,040, were given by Shinzo Abe to Donald Trump during visit to the Trump International Golf Club and the Kasumigaseki Country Club. The report says the National Archives and Record Administration does not have records of the clubs, and the General Services Administration has no records of the clubs being purchased. Today's preliminary findings suggest again that the Trump administration's brazen disregard for the rule of law and its systematic mishandling of large gifts from foreign governments, including many lavish personalized gifts that vastly exceed the statutory limit in value, but were never reported to the U.S. State Department, and some that are still missing today. According to Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee. Jamie Raskin also said the committee would remain committed to following the facts to determine the extent to which former President Donald Trump broke the law or violated the Constitution when he failed to report gifts and took possession of valuable items without paying the fair market price for them.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episodes, we have been talking about how to teach our children about love, to love people with all their goods and all their odds, whatever they have, And in the meantime, we also understood that it's also important to teach our children about the self-respect, about the idea that when they are expressing, when they are actually loving someone, we actually got to teach all these things through our upbringing, the way we behave with them. You said that we have to behave with them in the way that even when we are expressing a disagreement with them, it should be very respectful. You also shared one of the hadiths with us. I would want you to teach us more on the fact, like, for example, there are children who often, like, about their brothers or their sisters on the table, on the dining table, or anywhere in the room, like, whenever they are with the parents, they kind of try to say, she did this thing wrong, or I know you're wrong over here, I know you went wrong over here. So as they grow up, they try to be more like that. They try to be more that I am a kind of person who was right, and my sister or the brother, you need to correct yourself. So sometimes, yes, our brothers and sisters are at wrong place, but how do we say to them in a respectful manner?
So number one, we should try as parents, as siblings, to talk to them separately, in seclusion from others, so that they do not feel offended or let down in front of others. So if there is something which needs to be pointed out, it has to be corrected, it should be done, not in front of the others. Of course, sometimes you need to do that in front of others to make your point, strike at the iron when it is hot.
All right.
You need to, put hammer the nail in at a time when it is that thing is being done. So it has to be, you need to determine what situation is. Sometimes you have gone through the exercise of talking to them separately and trying to make them realize that they're making a mistake.
But you have failed all the time.
But then it comes, and the only solution left is that now you need to, put them, tell them off in front of others, so they feel bad about it. They feel maybe offended by it, but they remember that that would be coming to us if we're not careful and if we're not mannerful. So the important thing is when we talk about, for example, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar. So it has levels and it has conditions and it has certain levels. You start off with lower levels at a milder ways, and then you go to levels which are a little harsher. So it's not that we completely reject being harsh, or say that we should always be mild. But the first thing is the attempt should be to, manage the situation in a way that it does not make them lose their self-pride and respect. And that is done by doing so in a very beautiful and polite manner. Even in front of others, you can make a...
whenever the time you are actually trying to teach or guide, be that your siblings, be that your children, that they are wrong at some place, their self-respect has to be maintained. That is something that has not to be let get hurt. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the ways to actually guide a child to actually show his consent or show his disagreement towards a particular thing, maintaining the self-respect of the other party. Yes, Professor.
One of the important things is that you need to make your child or your sibling understand that whatever you're doing is based on what you feel inside. There has to be a coherence between your inner feelings and your outward expressions. What you feel and what you think, how you feel and think, should come outside also. People should realize that you're sincere. People should realize that you're truthful. What you want to say is, what you are saying is out of the heart. And you really want, you love the person, and you want him to be a good person. Loving him, loving a person is thinking positively, is thinking something should come about positively in the other person. You want him to be a better human being. That is your true love. The true love is what, and that you should make the person realize that what you are saying is something you really feel for. It's not something just of a facade that you...
Exactly. Professor, just last night I was going through a video of a psychiatrist, and she was saying that when you want, nobody actually likes the feedback, and especially the negative feedback, and why people don't like that, because they don't need validation from you. And but still, if you validate things like, hey, you are doing good, and then say, I would want you to be more better, rather than saying just fix a particular thing. So how much do you agree with this, that not to tell a person directly, hey, I want you to fix this, rather than telling this directly, telling that person at least, just appreciating or encouraging his one or two qualities, and then telling that person to fix this and this quality within you?
Yes, of course. There are two aspects to this, in my humble opinion. One aspect is the person who wants to express his love by telling the person off, that you fix this. So the better thing would be, as you said, you should start off with appreciating and praising him.
Yeah.
Appreciation should be first of things, because everything is not negative about the other person. There must be some good aspects to it, to him or her. So you can start off by appreciating him, praising him for things that are good about him. And within that, you present something which is, you need to rectify and correct.
Yeah.
That is one aspect,
all
certainly.
Right.
And through that, you are trying to...
show also sympathy and tell other person to fix
not
a
just
particular
sympathy,
problem.
You're showing empathy.
Yeah.
You want to make him feel that I feel for you.
All right.
And what you should be feeling for yourself, I'm also feeling like that.
All right.
So you need to empathize with the person in a way that he or she feels that you're really feeling for him. And and it's not, it's something for the betterment of not only myself, it's the betterment of my relationship with other human beings.
Professor,
the other aspect is that the person who's being told off, he should be prepared for anything.
Yeah.
He should not feel bad about it. He should think of things in a positive way.
Yeah.
Even if the person who is telling him off is doing it in an offensive way, but he should try to, reconcile with that, and he should try to justify that. Look, in any case, if he's telling me off, especially my parents, if one of my parents is becomes angry or is used to, scolding me and becoming angry, you should say, look, at the end of the day, he or she wants a better future for me.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't be put off. I shouldn't be...
Exactly.
You know.
Professor, we would want more explanation from you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Ya Muqiyal Khayrat,
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakawi, and we are discussing about how can you actually teach your child to teach other people to fix particular things in them in a very respectful manner. Yes, Professor.
Yes, so as I was saying, basically we need to show our love, we should show our compassion, empathize with them. They should feel that we're truthful with them, we're honest with them, we're sincere with them. We love them, and that's why we're asking them to be good people.
But Professor, don't you think most of the times we ask people to fix things in them, they feel very disrespectful, or they feel like, definitely the opposite person is jealous with me, and that's why this person wants me to fix the things. How do we develop this
sometimes
ideology?
It's because it depends upon how we feel towards them.
All right.
I mean, sometimes we feel that we feel the others' feelings towards us in the same way that we feel for them, in the same way we think for them. If we think positively about them, if we start to think positively about others, we will start thinking that they are also positive to us. If I feel jealous about the person, then I would say he also is
so
jealous.
So this is a vice versa process,
it's
kind of?
Yes, it is
a two-way
so
process.
If we want to change others also, we need to start from ourselves. And if we feel... for
charity example, begins at home.
Exactly. So we need to change our feelings. We need to make us ourselves realize that the other person is also a human being and we should respect him. And we should start loving him. Love means not forgetting yourself, but love means not forgetting others also.
All right.
I mean, yes, I'm not saying that we completely think of ourselves to be nothing. We lose everything. We lose our self-respect. No, we shouldn't feel so trampled down, but also we should not trample upon the other person. Our love for the other person, it should not be because of greed. Our love for some person should not be because I like him. No, because it's because he is a human being and I need to love him as a human being. So it should be based
on... It's a creation of Allah,
exactly.
And I got to be respecting
so the way I feel about him, I feel that he feels the same way. So even if someone comes with a positive attitude towards me, because I have a negative attitude, I think that he also has a negative attitude. And that is one of the problems which we face normally in society or at places of work. We do not accept the other person because we are not accepting. We feel that he doesn't accept us.
All right. So it's a somewhere deep down, us realize the problem. It's a two-way process. We'll discuss more on this in the upcoming episodes. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. Dear listeners, Imam Ali Alayhis Salam said, if you want to tell someone, fix a particular thing, tell him all alone, because that way you have actually taken him to a higher level and actually conveyed your thing. But if you're telling him in public, you have actually got him deep down and you have actually disregarded him, you have actually disrespected that person. So we got to be taking care of all these things. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.